We're going to take a little bit different of an approach this week. We're going to focus on various inyanim when it comes to Pesach, and I'm going to divide it into two. The first part will be certain Divrei Torah on Pesach, about five Divrei Torah, with the hopes that you'll enjoy them and remember them and be able to deliver them at your Siddurim, Seder, Siddurim, and throughout Pesach. So that'll be part one. I have to take notes, or I can email around, I guess, afterward. Yeah. I can do that also. So that's number one. And number two, if we have time permitting, we'll talk about various interesting shilas when it comes to Pesach, and I'd love to get your input on the shilas. So it goes as follows. I'll number them so we can see when one ends and when one begins. So Rabbi Abraham Twersky, Rabbi Dr. Professor Abraham Twersky, world-renowned psychiatrist, psychologist, rabbi, Hasidic rabbi, author of 70-something books, very prolific and brilliant, rav, insightful doctor. He asked the following question, and he's known for his dealings with abuse issues, alcohol addictions, drug addictions, various addictions. He had the Gateway Rehab Center in Pittsburgh that he headed for decades and decades. So he asked the following question. We know that Pesach is called Zman Cheuseinu, which means the time of our freedom, the time of our liberation. And he asked the fundamental question, what can we incorporate into our lives when it comes to liberation? It's very easy to slip into thinking Pesach is discussing something that happened to Klal Yisrael thousands of years ago, the Emancipation Proclamation of Klal Yisrael, long, long time ago. But what's the message that we can take with us into Pesach and coming out of Pesach? So he tells the following story, that there was a recovering alcoholic, actually a drug abuser, that was sitting at his Seder table. At the beginning of the Seder, his father starts singing Avadim Hayinu, Hayinu Bereth Mitzrayim. He only says Hayinu once. Avadim Hayinu Bereth Mitzrayim. And he's saying, we were slaves. And the son stops his father and says, Father, I got to tell you, you're saying Avadim Hayinu, that we were slaves, but you have no clue what it is to be a slave, which is not true. You're not a slave at all. You have no concept of slavery. But me, on the other hand, when I was abusing drugs, I had 100% zero control of myself, and I was 100% a slave to my addiction. I had zero free will, and that's the concept of slavery. I was a slave, and I would do things I would have never expected myself to do. I was totally out of control because I was controlled by my master, which was my drugs. And my Rabbi Twersky says, we see based on this that this concept of slavery and emancipation is not limited to physical bondage solely under a ruler, an owner, but it's a much broader concept when it comes to slavery. And he gives a number of examples of someone that can be a slave not only to his drugs and his alcohol and a slave to his cigarettes, but he can be a slave to himself. He can be a slave to his habits. He can be a slave to money. He can be a slave to his workplace. Technology. People that are constantly with us, the newest one is a slave to your WhatsApp, a slave to your email, a slave to all these other things. And he says these are all different forms of slavery that we need to redeem and liberate ourselves from. And he says something absolutely fascinating just when it comes to workplace. I remember that when I was working in New York, there was a partner at the firm that I was working on that used to bill, and unless you've billed hours, I don't know if you can appreciate this, he was billing 3,000 hours a year. 3,000 hours a year is working. 60
hours a week.
It's an unbelievable thing. Not Jewish, but he was working constantly. He would walk to the bathroom working on documents. I'm sure he was billing in the stall. It was unbelievable. I don't know how he had time to have kids, but he never saw them. Now,
what happened to this guy? He died at 45.
Yeah, I know. Yeah, one. I know. Okay. So there, this is not only a non-Jewish person. I remember being in Riverdale, New York, and my wife and I were. It was the day before Purim, the day of Purim, which was either a Wednesday or Thursday, and a friend of my wife's told her that she had not seen her husband since Motzei Shabbos. He was working at a law firm called Skadden Arps. So I actually knew him fairly well. It was the largest law firm, second to largest law firm in the world at the time. Maybe it's the largest now. And he was working on a deal, and he would sleep. When he got exhausted, he would take a so short nap on the floor and then get back to work. And she would, he had a fill-in at work, and she would send him clean clothing via car service because they had showers at the office, so hopefully that he used to use it. But she did, and the next day was Purim. She did not expect to see him until Shabbos. So that is a slave. That's slavery. So Rabbi Twersky says as follows: a person whose self-concept is dependent on what others think of him, or whose behavior is totally determined by what he thinks others want him to be, he too has no freedom. He's not free because he's not being himself. He's constantly concerned about what somebody could think about him, and he's adjusting what he should behave based on what others would, he thinks, what others would want him to do. So he says that that's the concept of Zman Cheruseinu. It's not only emancipation, liberation from actual slaves, but it's from anything that may be keeping us in bondage, be it external things or internal things that we should really try to liberate ourselves from on Pesach. So that's an important message as we go in and as we come out of Pesach, that we should be able to shed the things that are keeping us back from Avodas Hashem and try to free ourselves in order to go in the proper direction. Okay, number two goes as follows. In the Pasuk in Shmos, Perek Vav, Pasuk Yugimel. How do I remember that? Jonathan, help me out. Vav Yugimel. Thank you. There you go. 6:13. So that's how to remember the pasuk. The pasuk says as follows: Hashem spoke to Moshe and Aaron, and He commands them. Vayitzavem. He commands them to speak to Klal Yisrael and Paro to take Klal Yisrael out of Mitzrayim. What's bizarre about that pasuk? He commands Aaron and Moshe, command Klal Yisrael and command Paro to take Klal Yisrael out of Mitzrayim. Why do you need to command Klal Yisrael to take Klal Yisrael out of Mitzrayim? We can understand commanding Paro, let my people go. But we cannot understand why Hashem would have to command Davaya, Aaron, and Moshe that command Klal Yisrael to let... This is liberation. You'd think that the slaves, 210 years being enslaved, they'd be the first people waiting to let him out.
He knew his customers.
They knew?
He knew his customers.
He knew his customers. Well, why? 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 So the question is...
He had slave mentality.
But that was after the fact.
Later, right?
That was after the fact.
He had slave mentality.
So close. So very close. So it goes as follows. Rabbi Mordechai Kamenetsky tells the following story of the poor farmer that worked for the poorest, the wealthy, despotic landowner, and the deal was that 80% goes to the landowner, 20% goes to the poor farmer. Poor farmer has a wife to support, has a family to support. Life is miserable. They can barely make ends meet. They live off the few eggs that their chickens make and the milk that they can milk out of their cow. And life goes on, and it's miserable. And as the years go by, they never hope for better. One day, the poor farmer is in the shuk, in the marketplace. He comes back, and his wife looks at him and says, "You look terrible. What happened in the marketplace today? Looks like a terrible calamity has occurred." He says, "It's terrible. I heard the worst news. They're speaking in the marketplace that the Mashiach is going to come, and he's going to take us to Israel. How are we going to support ourselves? What's going to happen with our chickens? What's going to happen with our cow? Who's going to put a shelter over our head?" So the wife responds. She was a very frum lady with deep emunah. She says, "My dear husband, do not worry. HaKadosh Baruch Hu has protected us throughout history. He protected Klal Yisrael from Paro. He protected Klal Yisrael from Haman during Purim. He has protected us throughout the Golos. and I am confident that he will protect us from the Shmashiach also. And the message that Rav Mordechai Kamenetsky says is as follows: often in life, whether by chance or by choice, we enter into situations that we ought not be in. As time progresses, however, we get accustomed to the situation and our worst enemy becomes changed. And he says that with Klal Yisrael, the worst enemy, even though life was miserable, what, 210 years, you get stuck in a rut. And they were stuck in a rut, but that's all they knew was slavery. Their biggest enemy became making any type of change. And that could be if you're stuck in a minyan that you don't like davening in, or you have a friend that you don't like, but that's all you know, a relationship, whatever it may be. We get stuck in a rut. That's human nature, and we're always worried, but maybe it's going to be worse without this, and we don't like making a change. And that's what happened to Klal Yisrael, that they got stuck in a rut, and they didn't want to make a change because they became numb to thinking there could be anything better. And that's why Hashem says to Moshe and Aaron, you need to also command Klal Yisrael, they need to make a change. So now we can understand that pasuk in 6:13, Perek Vav, pasuk Yud Gimel. Okay, so that's number two. Number three goes as follows: one of the Aseres HaMakos was Sfardea. What does Sfardea mean? The first thing that you said was right. You said frog first, right? So as we know, the pasuk says that the Sfardea, single tense, the Sfardea ascended from the Nile. Sfardea. So Rashi brings the Medrash, the known Medrash, that says that initially it was one frog. One frog. There's a book, Harparsha Mis, apparently. I don't know if anyone's seen it. See it? So it comes in English, Hebrew, and Yiddish. So I was reading it to my kids. I remember from a few years ago that on Parshas Vayera, it has the Tzfardea. Parshas Vayera. So it has a picture of one massive frog coming out of the Nile. That's what it is. Tzfardea. Big, big, big frog. I remember when I used to go to camp from Los Angeles to New York as a kid, and my uncle or my father used to come with us, or an uncle used to pick me up and get us up to camp. And once my Uncle Chaim Wasserman, he picked me up from the airport, and he took me out to a restaurant in Brooklyn in Flatbush. And it was a place restaurant, and on the menu it said meatballs. And what came out of the out of the kitchen was a meatball the size of a softball. It wasn't meatballs. It was tzfardea. It was meatball. And I remember I was like 9 years old, and I was cutting this. And I was like, if you're thinking of the slav, that Klal Yisrael got so sick of eating the slav that it was just like coming out of their mouth, like another slice and another slice. And I was like, oh, it's only halfway through. So that's the concept. It was like a massive frog came out, and the meat stream got irritated. So what do? They start hitting it. And what happens? It split. And they hit it again. Clone, 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 more and more. Divides, divides, divides. And that's what happened. And there were thousands and tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands, Tzfardeim, that originated from that original Tzfardea. So the Stifler Gaon asks a simple but brilliant question. If they saw that the more they hit the frog, the more they hit the frogs, the more they would split, why didn't they stop hitting the frogs? It's a very simple, obvious, but brilliant question. Stop hitting, wake up and smell the coffee. Robin Williams would say, if you remember, woke up and smell the hummus if you're in the Middle East. Well, What is it?
Aladdin.
Aladdin, yes. Woke up and smell the hummus, right? So woke up and wake up and smell the hummus. A good bikiyas there. So that's what the stipple asks. It's just like Aladdin, right? Just smell the coffee here. So the stipple answers back as follows: that when a person becomes angry, and the angrier and angrier you get, you lose all self control, and the result of that is that the more self control you lose, the more you do inane, illogical things that are even to one's own detriment. So we see here that the angrier you get, the worse it is. And you do things that even work, that are counterproductive. They're going to hurt you. And nonetheless, we see the Mitzrayim, they were hurting themselves because they lost their cool and they kept doing, they kept getting angrier and angrier. They were not able to stop themselves from this cycle of beating up those frogs to their own detriment. So Rabbi Fran goes the next step and says that is talking about somebody who even just gets angry occasionally, that they do things, they lose control, and they hurt themselves. But the Gemara Nedarim, Chaf Bey, says that somebody who is constantly angry, kol minei gehenim sholtim bo, which means all types of hell, gehenim, will be controlling that person. All types of hell. Somebody who's constantly angry, that's what will be controlling him, is all types of hell. So the pashtus, what that means is, when he goes up to after Mea Vastrim, maybe he's not going to get to Mea Vastrim, it's not good for your cardiac activity to be constantly like that. You like that, Doc? So it's not...
What about George? He's got a great story about his friend got angry and he had a stroke and he died. And so he's talking about how the guy said, I don't want to be like that guy. So every time I think about an argument, I think about I don't want to be like that guy.
I had a boss like that whose father passed away at 52 from a massive heart attack, and he had a real anger problem, and this boss had to control his anger because he didn't want to be like his father who passed away from a heart attack because of his anger issues. So the Rabbeinu Yerucham says the postures of this Gemara means that somebody who's constantly angry, kol minei gehenim sholtim, but we think of Pshuta as when he goes up to heaven, or goes down to hell, he's going to be punished in many ways for his anger problems. He says actually what it means is culminating gehenim sholtim bo means not only in the world to come, but even in this world, this person is living in a gehenim. He doesn't have to wait till the world to come. Even in this world, this person is constantly living in gehenim because he's constantly angry. So that's what we learn from these Sfardeim, that it's obviously always important to control one's anger and try to put things in perspective. Okay, that was number three. Number four is fantastic. It goes as follows, a little bit complicated. When we sit down at the Seder, we say, L'shana Abba, B'Yushalayim, that we should have the Beis HaMikdash, the Reis HaMikdash should be restored. We should be able to bring the... We're sitting at the Lala Seder. What are we missing?
Korban Pesach.
We don't have the Korban Pesach. That's a controversy in and of itself. Can the Korban Pesach be brought nowadays? We're going to put that aside. We're going to take the conventional view, the conventional view that it cannot be brought nowadays.
On Wednesday, the Pittsburghans are bringing their Korban Pesach in Mount Grayson.
Atzlacha. So we're going to take the conventional, normal view that it cannot be brought nowadays. So the question then is, why not? Because we don't have the Beis HaMikdash. Why don't we have the Beis HaMikdash? It was destroyed. Why was it destroyed? Sinaschinim. Sinaschinim is the reason why we can't bring the Korban Pesach nowadays. Why is Sinaschinim not mentioned Leil HaSeder? Why don't we have a discussion of Sinas Chinam, fortuitous hatred of other Jews? That should be a discussion piece, a very fundamental discussion piece, a mention of it. This should be something that is discussed at the Seder, and it doesn't seem to be mentioned at all as the reason why we don't have the Korban Pesach. So the Ben Ishnai says beautifully, he says, in fact, there is an allusion to Sinas Chinam in the Manishtana. We're in the Manishtana, so he says, we have four questions in the Mishtana. One of the questions is, on all other nights, we don't dip at all. And tonight at the Leil HaSeder, how many times? Two times. Two times, he says. So what's going on here? He says as follows. What are the two dippings that we do at the Leil HaSeder? Number one is?
Karpas.
We karpas into the salt water. And number two?
Maror.
Into the charoses. We're dipping into the charoses. So he says beautifully, I love this Ben Ishchai. He says the first dipping that we do at the Leil HaSeder, which is into the salt water, corresponds to the first dipping that we have in the Chumash. What's the first dipping we have in the Chumash?
The goat by Yehuda.
By the Achim, by Yosef, by Yosef, the first dipping is when we have the brothers, they were going to kill Yosef, they put him into the pit, okay, let's not do this, we'll sell him off, then they take his technicolor dream coat, what do they do with it? They dip it of an animal, they dip it in and they say to their father, Dad, who's this? He says, Oy, Gewalt. He must have been killed. And so the Ben Ishchai says beautifully, that dipping was the ultimate illustration of Sinas Chinam between the brothers. That was the hatred that the brothers had to Yosef, Yosef had to the brothers. There was a tremendous Sina between them. And that dipping that we do at the Leila Seder into the salt water symbolizes that first dipping of Sinas Chinam into the blood of the brothers. That is what's symbolized by dipping into the salt. And the second dipping into the Charoses that we have represents the second dipping in the Tanakh. When was the second dipping in the Tanakh?
Lakach Ezov.
Lakach Agudas Ezov. Take the Agudas Ezov. When was that?
Yetzias
Mitzrayim. The Leila Seder, right? When we get out. Klal Yisrael was told to bring the Korban Pesach, dip the Agudas Ezov into the Aguda, that's like a bundle of like a brush of Ezov, of hyssop, and dip it into the blood and paint your doorposts. And the Ben Ishchai says, what is Agudas Ezov? What is that coming? What's an Aguda?
Each other.
Unity. Yes, unity. Eged. Right? We have tremendous unity of the bus drivers in Eged, right? Agudas Ezov. That's why they give each other the right of way, although they give no one else. So that's Aguda. They are an Aguda together. So that's Agudas Ezov. This is the dipping that represents the unity of Klal Yisrael at the Leila Seder. And he says, in fact, that the second dipping at the end of their stay in Egypt, which was the prelude to getting out, was the remedy to the first dipping of the brothers of Yosef. This is the remedy that we want to counteract the Sinas Chinam with Avas Chinam in unity of Klal Yisrael. So the Ben Ishchai says beautifully that those two dippings, in fact, the second one is coming to remedy the first one. The first one is Sinas Chinam. The second one is Avas Chinam. We need to remedy the Sinas Chinam at the Seder.
Yeah, I just wanted to add about the Yosef's coat. Because even in the word karpas, there's an allusion to Yosef's coat because it was soft and silky. And the word kar apparently means, I don't know which one means what, but one that means soft, one that means kar.
Ksoras pasim.
Yeah, pasim, right.
Right,
so
very good. Kaya.
One means soft and one means silky, and that's what the coat was.
Ah. So just to go to the next step, Rav Chanan Wasserman asked the following question. He expressed amazement, all of the slanders of the anti-Semites against Klal Yisrael. What's the constant thing that we hear over and over throughout the generation? Blood libels. Blood libels. What is a blood libel? That the Jews kill Christian babies and they use the blood in their matzah. Rav Chanan says, that's a ridiculous claim. The last thing we would want to do is have blood. Blood is usher for a Jew to eat. So where is the basis to have this recurring, nonsensical basis claim against Klal Yisrael? Where does that come from? So he says something very powerful. He says, Rav Chanan Wasserman suggests that it is a divine punishment that corresponds to the sin of they dipped Yosef's coat into blood. It was in response, it was a divine decree that because the brothers, they went and they dipped that coat into the blood, we now have a kitrug against us, prosecution against us through all generations of the blood libel. When the brothers dipped Joseph's coat into blood, that did something into the system of heavenly justice, which caused Jews and future generations to be susceptible to the slanderous libel that we bake our matzahs with the blood of Gentile children. That is the basis for that blood libel.
Maybe,
now,
maybe the basis for the poisoning of the water, poisoning of the wells, is because we threw them in the well.
So just to go one more step, Rabbi Sachs, I don't know if you saw that, Rabbi Jonathan Sachs, the former chief rabbi of the UK, He wrote a piece for Newsweek recently, a brilliant piece for Newsweek, called Anti-Zionism is the New Anti-Semitism. I highly recommend it. It's also on his website, rabbisacks.org. And I'm just going to read two paragraphs of that write-up, of that article that fits beautifully with this. Anti-Semitism, this sentence is unbelievable. He says, anti-Semitism is a virus that survives by mutating. Brilliant sentence. In the Middle Ages...
Is it what? The?
Is a virus that survives by mutating. In the Middle Ages, Jews were hated because of their religion. In the 19th and 20th centuries, they were hated because of their race. Today, they are hated because of their nation state, Israel. Anti-Semitism is the new... Anti-Zionism is the new anti-Semitism. He goes on, next paragraph, legitimization has also changed throughout history. When people have sought to justify anti-Semitism, they have done so by recourse to the highest source of authority available within the culture. In the Middle Ages, it was religion. In post-Enlightenment Europe, it was science. Today, it is human rights. It is why Israel, the only fully functioning democracy in the Middle East, with a free press and independent judiciary, which includes Arabs as judges, is regularly accused of the five crimes against human rights: racism, apartheid, crimes against humanity, ethnic cleansing, and attempted genocide. And this is the caps it all. This is the blood libel of our time. So I think that all pulls it together, that originated way back with the Sinas Chinam of the dipping of the coat, the technicolor coat by the brothers. That's the ultimate example of Sinas Chinam. Rav Elchanan says that has chased us and prosecuted us throughout history as the blood libel. And today we are seeing that as the blood libel is anti-Zionism, anti-Israel, and culminated by the BDS movement.
Rabbi, since it mutates so well, why is it that we always have to respond to anti-Semitism? Because all we're doing is hitting the spot there.
Even when you have a virus, it may go, but you got to attack it. You got to attack it. Okay, so...
Why anti-Semitism has made us survive? If the government didn't hate us, we have...
Promoted resilience.
We will have
there's resilience, like China. And there's at a certain point it becomes incredibly virulent. And if we could keep it in the more healthy, unhealthy area as opposed to the unhealthy, unhealthy area, and that's unfortunately what we're managing now.
It should be example. This is before the birth pains of Mashiach, so Rabbi Blumen Grant's book in the beginning talks about, so after the Golos of Rome, the last part of it is the Golos of Ishmael. And it says that's the full court press. Now that there's some, including Jews, that are sponsoring a $100 million campaign on the anniversary of the 50th anniversary of the liberation of Jerusalem to blast Israel all over the world for all these five things you're talking about.
Okay, we're going to go into the second part of the shiur. We'll go through four different interesting shilas. I will defer to you as the bastion here to Haskin the shilas. So the following question was posed to Rav Zilberstein in the Varevna. There was a maisa that a very caring Jew, benevolent Jew, decided he wants to take care of people who could not afford their matzahs. So he said, I'm dedicating $10,000. I don't know what city it was in, where it is. But he said, I'm donating $10,000. People who come, they tell me they need. I'll ask them what their needs are, how many family members, and I'll give them money in order to go buy their matzah. So, chein have, they were in the process. They were giving out. Various people were coming. It wasn't apparently a throng of people, but people were coming for the needs. So one day somebody comes over and says, you know, I have a need. So the donor says to this individual who comes requesting assistance, he says, okay, how many members do you have in your household so I can see how much to give you for your matzah? So the person responds, no, I have matzah. That's not my problem. I have matzahs at home. My problem is that I can't eat it. I can't eat it, whether it's soft, whether it's hard. I can't eat it because I have no teeth. And my problem is I can't afford the dentures, of the nowadays we'd say the implants, in order to be able to eat the matzah. So if you can please help me out financially, I need teeth, I need dentures, I need the dental work necessary in order for me to do the mitzvah matzah. So the donor says, you know, thanks for coming, but I'm giving the money for matzah, not for
teeth.
Dentures. That's not teeth. That's not what this gemach is for. This gemach is for matzah. And the needy individual responded back, you know, the whole reason you're doing this is to enable people to do the mitzvah of matzah. That's what I need from you. I need you to enable me to do the mitzvah of matzah. It's just a little bit different of a form. You're not giving me the matzah, you're giving me the teeth to do it in, but that's what I need. And the guy says, like, you know, this is a matzah gemach, it's not a teeth gemach, it's not a denture gemach. So that question was posed to Rav Zilberstein, should the donor give him for his teeth or should he not? What do you think on that one? Yaakov.
Well, there's a huge price disparity. I don't know exactly, they'll have to tell us how much dentures cost, but I think it's more than the matzah disparity between that and matzah, so it doesn't really seem to make sense. I mean, it's unfortunate as a problem, but it doesn't seem to make sense that he has to support this guy instead of 200 families. No, it's a great question.
That's why I tried to, he didn't mention, like, and that's why I said it's not clear where it is, but there weren't 3,000 people waiting online, so it's, he doesn't get into that question. I think
so
we would say that if he's gonna, for his teeth, he's gonna, 100 people aren't gonna get, or 50 people aren't gonna get, that I think we would say. But I don't think it was like that competitive, that.
So that might change the answer a little bit, but
it still seems good. Well, he didn't represent, he said this is what the gemach is. He didn't say it's a gemach for anybody who wants to fill their mitzvah for matzah. He said this is a gemach for matzah.
What's the question? Does he have to give?
He have to give.
It sounds like he's putter from eating matzah, so.
You know, his language is, the Baal HaBayis is concerned that he is going to take away from his neder. Meaning, am I allowed to give him? And that's why he asked, and he said, let me go ask a shayla. More it's like, am I allowed to give for this?
Allowed.
Or am I not? Am I not allowed? Because I made a neder to give to matzah. If I give to teeth, I'm not giving to matzah.
Use this money.
Could this money be used for...
Make it to some sort of... mush.
Into some sort of what?
Mush. Swallow it, maybe.
He's not able to, no matter what.
Sephardic pizzas. Sephardic matzahs are pizzas.
Crush the matzah and then use a straw. Matzah meal. Matzah meal. He's in a setup that says there's no way. Lo tchuna, I can't do a tachun, I can't do it. I can't. I got nothing there. I got gums. All right, so he answers as follows. He brings a pasuk in Shmos Yudbeis that says as follows, Im yimat habayis miyos misel. He says that Gemara Pesachim explains that if you have a house that they have too few people, they have too much meat on their korban pesach, for the people they can partner up. They can have a chabura, they can have shutfus together. Now the Gemara says that you can also, if the person are financially needy, but they have enough meat, but they need assistance in, for example, having wood for their korban pesach. That's also a valid means, even though they have the meat, they have the korban pesach. But we need assistance with things that are secondary to the korban pesach itself. The Gemara says that that's acceptable, that because it's a mitak in the korban pesach, kegufa de pesach dami. It's as if those partners are participating and contributing to the korban pesach itself. Even though they're just giving the eitzim, even though they're just giving the wood, but that's necessary for the korban pesach, that would be the same. So he says the same thing applies here, even though the neder was for matzah. But we would say the same thing, that as long as they're facilitating somebody's eating of the matzah, it's kagufa for the matzah itself. So that would say, he says the same thing would apply to giving somebody's teeth. Yeah, that would be, even though it's the matzah, but you're still, it's kagufa, it's like the kagufa of the Pesach, the Korban Pesach, this is like the kagufa of the matzah also, supplying something, even though it's like an accessory to the item itself, it's an accessory to the matzah, it's like you're supplying the wood, it's an accessory to the Korban Pesach, that's acceptable. This would also be acceptable, supplying an accessory. What? And this is the... Yeah, he's not...
He's saying, I need the water, because I can't wash my hands. I don't have water, I can't wash my hands.
You know, I don't know how far it extends. You know, I need clothing, otherwise I can't go to... I don't think that's what it's saying. You know, it's something that is directly associated with the Korban Pesach, that directly leads to the bringing of the Korban Pesach. What's that? Yeah. I know these are all stretches, so it's like, okay, question number two is as follows. There was a disagreement between a husband and wife. They did not have a lot of financial assets, and the question was how to use those assets coming into Pesach. The husband was insisting that with the money that they had, which was only enough for clothing for one of them, he was insisting that he buy her a new dress for Pesach. And she, on the other hand, was saying, no, I prefer not. I'd like you to buy yourself clothing for Pesach. Your clothing is very worn out. Your bekesha is whatever it is. Your outer coat is very worn out. You're a Talmud Chacham. You can't be walking around with tattered clothing. And she says as follows. Number one, it will bring me Simchas Yontif to see you wearing a proper garment. And number two, it's Kavod HaTorah because you are a Talmud Chacham. So I insist that you buy yourself the clothing and not use it for me. And the question was posed to Rav Zilberstein, to what should those, that allotment that they have, should it go towards his clothing or her clothing?
Well, Mar says that it's an obligation for him to make her rejoice. She doesn't have any obligation.
But she's saying her rejoicing is clothing on him.
It's like I'm getting married because of the schluss that you're going to take my gift.
So what would you say?
I would say that she I would go with her.
Buy it for her?
No, I'd buy it for him.
Buy it for him because of two reasons, or that because she's rejoicing from that?
Because his gift to give her simcha.
His chiyev and her simcha is...
His chiyev to buy her clothing is to give her simcha. So and she's saying to give me simcha...
Is to have you clothing.
Is for you.
Dorash Tama the Kra. Okay. We have a machlokas tachtoni.
No,
you said he should buy his clothing.
No, he was saying listen to her.
Listen to her.
He has to buy it for her.
Listen to her and the clothing should go for him.
He has to buy it for her. He has to buy the clothing.
All right, we have a...
So Rick is saying it should be bought if what?
Why? Because I think the mitzvah is to give her simcha, and I think it's to buy her... Isn't the begadim something essential? I think we buy begadim for the wife.
Or tachshitim. Or,
right,
or
exactly.
So Rick is saying it has to be specifically that. We can't look into, how would she subjective? There's an objective criteria that the halacha says the simcha of a wife... She's saying, okay, so he comes out as follows. The Kaf HaChaim Paskins as follows. Binyan HaMalbushim, when it comes to clothing, Ha'isha Kademes LaBala, the wife comes first before the husband. She Asela HaMalbushim Naim, so it should be for her, not for him. She comes before him. And he says, even though she claims that she would have simcha by seeing him, we paskin that the simcha of a wife, of a lady, should be through tangible items, as Rick is saying. Tangible items, Allah says, through clothing or tachshitim or jewelry, and that she can't simply say, I'm going to have more simcha in a more metaphysical way from my husband having clothing. We paskin that she comes, takes priority, and specifically the priority comes not as a subjective criteria, but it should be through material items like clothing and tachshitim. So he would have to buy her the clothing. He would not get the beged. So there's a follow-up question to that. There was a similar discussion between a husband and wife. They had... loans outstanding. They had a debt outstanding, and the question was, should they use the money to pay off the debt or to buy her clothing? She says, I'd rather you pay off the debt. That will lower my stress coming into the Chag, knowing that we have paid off this debt rather than buying me clothing. So that's when I read the Shaila, I thought it was a Dover Poshut. That you have the obligation to pay off.
So I was
thinking exactly the same thing. I'll give the answer. And they throw a curveball in here and says, you know, there's a Gemara that says that there's certain things that are not included.
Talmud Torah. Shabbat.
Yontif.
No, but Tishri. That's what they Tishri.
Reish
is
Talmud Torah. Shabbos. Yontif and Rosh Chodesh. Sudas Rosh Chodesh.
And Yontif.
So this is one of the items that are not included in the budgets that we receive from Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippur. So paying the buying the, for the Tzorach Yontif of her clothing is not going to take away from. But he puts in a very important parenthetical here, in a parentheses, smaller text, which I think should be the bold, larger text. He says, V'choze kishemeshar er shiyitziyeh lo efsharos lifroet chobosav. This all applies if you can estimate, if you properly assume that he'll be able to pay off al piteva his debts otherwise.
Al piteva, but you added that.
I did, but I think that's what it's saying. Kim shimishayar shetiyelo efshar. That is going to be.
No,
it's talking realistically. This is saying, you realistically, do you think you have an ability to pay off your debts otherwise? And if you don't think you'll pay off your debts otherwise, then it doesn't go for a closing, it goes for pay off the debt. So I would turn around and say, you've got, you know, if you think you pay it off, fine, buy the clothing. But if you're concerned that you're not going to be able, if you use it for the clothing, you're not going to be able, then it should be used to pay off the debts. Okay, so that was number 2 or 3, don't know. Last Shaila of the night.
Three,
thank you, Yehuda. Last Shaila of the night, fascinating Shaila. Is there was the proverbial Reuven that his friend Shimon approaches him on Erev Pesach and says, I'm going away. I have a wad of bills. I would like you to watch it over. Are you amenable to watching over my money while I go away to the Pesach program at Kibbutz Lavi or whatever it may be, to the Cayman Islands? And Reuven says, absolutely, I'm happy to watch over the money. Not a problem. The Reuven's house is broken into, and the money is stolen. When they looked into the issue, they looked into the situation. Reuven lel shimurin lel aseder, the night of protection. Turns out that he left his door unlocked. Lel shimurim, right? He left the door open, and a ganav comes in and stalls it. He stalls. Shimon comes back from his Pesach program at a great time, has a beautiful suntan. He goes to Reuven and says, Reuven, I'd like my bills back. Reuven says, sorry. Eliyahu Navi was not the thief. He says, sorry, it was stolen. So Shimon says, "Well, you're negligent. You left the door open." So Reuven goes over and pulls out a Shulchan Aruch, and in the Magen Avraham, Shimon Tapei Aleph, he says, brings in the name of the Gadol, the Maharil, Shebelel Aseder, which is Lel Shimurim Lo Yinol Atadelas B'Briach Chazak. Don't lock your door with a strong lock. Don't lock it up. So he says, I wasn't negligent. It's based on the Maharil that says that Lel Shimurim, we don't have to be locking up. So Shimon says,
when you were there.
No, he was there. He was there at night. Reuven was there, went to sleep. So Shimon says, no, you know what? You were negligent. You were negligent. Leaving your door, I don't know what the Maharil is saying. You were negligent. The money was stolen. You may have a collection issue there, but good luck on collecting. So he says, you were negligent. You left it on. The question was posed to Rav Zilberstein, does Reuven have to pay up, or does he not have to pay up because of the Maharil's minhag to not lock up because it's lel shimurim? Not down there.
I would say he has to pay.
Why?
Because I might not have to lock my door, but if I'm watching something of yours,
right,
my responsibility
is higher.
It's higher.
Anyone disagree with that? What was that?
Reuven also had, let's say, $1,000.
That we don't know.
Well, assuming he did.
Then Reuven wouldn't have to pay Reuven back.
Yeah, Reuven wouldn't have to pay Shimon back. Right?
Why?
Because
he says, I lost also.
He says, it was predicated upon Lael Shmurim, and I'm also subject my own
But,
yeah,
but
so in any case,
but you could say in any case,
I had my cattle got stolen with your cattle. Who cares?
You're saying I should on somebody else's chesh, but I shouldn't make it leil shmur. That's what you're saying, which is correct. But if I made it on my own,
but Jonathan's saying it's a higher level of responsibility.
I could treat myself.
Of course you could. If I'm managing your money, I would manage it. I'd be more careful.
I'm managing your money. I'm doing exactly what I did to myself.
It doesn't matter. He did it. I think
you decided to
have a higher duty.
You decided to shoot yourself in the foot.
Himself to guard someone's money, and then he was a little bit light about that. I mean, seems to me at a higher
responsibility.
If you shoot somebody else in the foot, can you shoot? You shoot somebody.
Okay, but as well doesn't.
No, as well. Okay. Anyway.
So he says as follows. Sorry, he says. I shall read it in sight, so I don't get held responsible. Aval look, he says the Maril. This went to Rav Eliashiv. I guess it got appealed to Rav Eliashiv. Rav Eliashiv, Rav Zilberstein's father-in-law. So they asked Rav. The serious style is they go up the ladder. They went to Rav Eliashiv and says this Maril is a very very important zach. The Maril, source of great minhagim of Klal Yisrael, for Ashkenazim, true. So that applies. That something that really has to be taken into consideration. It's a Elshimur. We have to take it seriously. However, if you're holding somebody else's asset, Shaz Tzarech Lishol, you should have asked him if he's okay with you leaving the door open. And if he didn't consent and it was stolen, you would have to pay back. Ki chovaso shel adam klape azulat ki kemuvor b'raka, because you do have a higher responsibility when you're watching over somebody else's assets. So that's what he says, point number one. Point number two, he says, v'ima dubar mamakam shemitsuyas b'genevus, if you're in a place that robberies are common, even for your own assets, you should not be leaving your door open. This can apply in Chicago, West Rogers Park, where they leave their door opens all the time and people are in and out. That would be maybe an appropriate place, but not a place to do it when you have regular. I remember we rented. We came 3 summers before we moved to Israel in Ramat Eshkol, and there were regular robberies because there's a valley right out. There's a forest right there, and the Arabs would come from the forest and be they know when people were away, and this and that would be common robberies. 5 to 10 a week. So a place that robberies are regular, even no one should leave their door open. Now, I would add one more point. If we read, strictly speaking, this Maharil, his language is as follows. Lo yinol et hadelet bebaria chazak. That means don't lock it with a strong deadbolt. I don't know if he says specifically don't lock it at all. Don't go overboard. We should have some emuna, but don't leave your door open. Don't leave it totally unlocked. So it could be that the Maharil himself, based on his language, would be saying, you know, use a smaller lock. Don't have to use the full deadbolt, but something. It's possible. He doesn't say that, but I would say.
You have like four locks, four deadbolts?
So use one. Use one of them.
Are people knowing to follow
I don't
relax their locking of their door?
I don't. We lock our doors. So, but I would say nowadays it's pretty matzui that they're robberies. All right. So that's it. Thank you for all your responses on the shaylas. It should be a wonderful chag kasher v'sameach. We should experience tremendous liberation next week. We will be doing our own bedikas chametz, so there will not be shir next week. We will have off, obviously, the week afterward. That it will be yontif. So Amir Tzachem, we will continue after Pesach. Have a chag. Kashav Sameach.